This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following is an encore presentation that first aired on August 17, 2021. The Texas Tribune reports that in June, Governor Greg Abbott signed into law HB 3979. The law restricts how U.S. history and current events can be taught in Texas schools. It's often called the Critical Race Theory Bill, even though the term critical race theory is not found anywhere in it. In signing the bill, Governor Abbott noted that critical race theory must be abolished in Texas. In addition, he announced that he would ask the legislature to address the issue further during a special session. The Texas legislation reflects a noisy debate throughout the country. About a year ago, Christopher Rufo, senior fellow for the conservative Manhattan Institute, began to use the term critical race theory in an attempt to denounce anti-racist education efforts. Since that time, use of the term has snowballed. Alarmed conservatives claim that CRT is the basis for teaching children that they are racist and that the U.S. is a racist country with tarnished roots. Senator Ted Cruz and others have labeled CRT itself racist since it emphasizes the role of racial conflict in U.S. history. Monica Martinez, member of the UT history faculty, notes that the current curriculum already teaches that one race is superior. She observes, "Look at how it teaches the history of the Texas Revolution, that people like Stephen F. Austin are racially superior to the treacherous Mexicans like Santa Anna. Texas history has been taught in a way that celebrates people who were fighting for the institution of slavery, that were espousing publicly that Mexicans were an inferior race." The Texas Tribune concludes that some teachers fear that the law may have a chilling effect on efforts to nurture critical thinking, which promotes inclusion of multiple perspectives on historical events to illustrate how the past has impacted current issues. They quote Andrew Robinson, an eighth grade history teacher in Dallas. "What they're trying to say with this is that the actions of the past aren't affecting the present. They want us to act like slavery and Jim Crow have no bearing on the issues in our society right now. And if that's the case, then they should cancel my class." Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guest this evening is David DeMatthews, Associate Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy at UT Austin. Last month, he wrote an opinion piece for the Austin American Statesman titled SB 3 Seeks to Rewrite History. That should concern all Texans. We also have regular guest Jim Harrington, retired founder of the Tech Civil Rights Project. And Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of this program, joins us as well. David, how are you doing?
Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us. Let's start off with just a little about your background. Tell us how you got to UT here and what you teach and your research areas.
Sure. So I actually started my career in education as a social studies teacher, an American government teacher in Baltimore. So I got my initial interest in history as an undergraduate, and then I went into teaching because I was passionate about history. I worked as a school administrator. I worked as a district administrator in Baltimore City and the District of Columbia Public Schools. And then after receiving my PhD in education, I became a professor at UTEP first, University of Texas at El Paso, which is on the border. And that exposed me to a different community than I was used to working in. And now for the last 3 years, I've been at UT Austin, working in the Department of Educational Leadership, where we primarily prepare aspiring principals, aspiring superintendents, and also researchers who would work for think tanks or work for a state department of education.
Well, I don't even know where to begin with all this, but the topic is revisionism in U.S. history. And this is not my area. I'm actually an engineer by training. But in recent years, I've become much more aware of what's been left out of U.S. history, had just a slight exposure to Howard Zinn and some others. Maybe you could lead off, David, just talking a little about revisionism and how is it that we're more aware of all this right now in history?
Sure. So I think a lot of attention now is coming the way in which textbooks and curriculum are designed and who they privilege, I think especially with social movements and with social media. I'm 39, I'm not that old, but even the history that I grew up with in high school, it really privileged one primary perspective of, say, American government or American history, and it didn't really tell you some of the counter stories or narratives. And for me, it wasn't really till I went to public university where I started to learn more about history from different perspectives. And I think that was really eye-opening for me. And I began to question in my 20s, well, why is it that you have to get to college to, say, learn more about civil rights movement or the Chicano movement or women's suffrage? How come that is not embedded in the curriculum in elementary, middle, and high school? So that was something that I think has been concerning. And so there's researchers that have focused very specifically curriculum and how it's developed and who it privileges. My research and my role has really focused on the role that school leaders can play in supporting teachers in adapting, creating inclusive and culturally responsive learning environments. So I think it's been an issue for a long time in this country where there's been revisionist history, partly based on who's been writing it. But now I think there's an opportunity because it's easy to get teachers new resources. There are different movements and activists that are championing different perspectives. And I think there's also a desire among students of all ages to learn more about the diverse perspectives of people and the founding of this country and also the future direction, what the history tells us about where we might be going.
But here in the state of Texas, I mean, there are plenty of people who would probably label that subversive.
Yeah, there very well could be. And some of that may be attached to their prior experiences and what they've learned in their Texas history class or in their U.S. history classes. Or maybe it's tied to some facet of their identity that they view as under attack right now. But I really think if we could step into a bubble for a minute and away from social media and cable news, and we just talked about the history that's been pretty well documented, I think we could probably get past a lot of the comments of calling each other subversives or racists or, you know, whatever the attack of the moment might be.
Jim, you know, you as founder of the Texas Civil Rights Project, surely you must have seen a lot of this as well in your work.
Yeah, we did. I mean, we did have some cases against universities, for example, students whose rights were infringed upon. But, you know, I think it was interesting working in the Valley for 10 years because I heard a lot of this stuff orally from people, the history of Texas that was different than what's in the textbooks. And so I think I've been sort of attuned to that for a while. And of course, you have the quintessential fake fact of the Alamo, the way the kids are taught about that, and in reality, what's going on. You know, I did a book on the Texas Bill of Rights, its origins, and so on. But the thing that struck me in that this is not part of our history that we're taught either is that when we redid the Constitution after the Civil War, you know, there were progressive parts of it and progressive parts that did not find their ways into the other Southern constitutions. And there was an alliance made between poor whites and blacks and Mexicans against the monopolies and the railroads and the banks. And they had power. So what happened then is that 90% of the black community voted at that time. It's pretty amazing. The only way that the establishment could deal with it was introducing the Klan, the rule of terror in Texas. And all that stuff is not taught, you know, and I think it's so important. And the history of the Texas Rangers, of course, you know, there were like 4,000 people in Texas, black and Hispanic, that were lynched or shot in the back, as was typically the case of the Texas Rangers. But I think it's really important, you know, and I really appreciate having read that article, because it gets this stuff out into public. It gets that discussion going. It helps us understand our state and where we are right now. That's a long answer to a short question.
It's okay. So David, Jim cites the Texas Rangers, and I think a number of us have read about, I think it was one massacre in particular that was fairly horrific. Can you cite some other specific examples of things that are only now really becoming more commonly known than they were certainly in U.S. history textbooks that most of us learned from?
Well, I mean, I think one thing recently that's kind of come into the spotlight, and I've even had some students of mine who are teachers and assistant principals ask, is the book Forget the Alamo, and kind of speaking more to a factual account of the Battle of the Alamo and the individuals who were involved and the contributions of Tejano. So I think that's probably one of the biggest ones right now. And since it got a lot of fanfare and attention with all that's gone on in the past month or so, I think that's one particular area teachers right now are going to be more interested in. If, of course, some of the legislation and proposed legislation doesn't cool teachers' desires to take on some of these issues.
Right. Well, speaking of which, you know, I'm trying to sort out the legislation. I think the bill that was actually signed into law was HB 3979. Could you tell us what that's about?
Sure. So kind of an interesting phenomenon happened across the country. A lot of these kind of bills were labeled as like anti-critical race theory bills. HB 3979 didn't speak specifically to critical race theory, which is, you know, something we could talk about. But really what that bill included was some language around the fact that teachers cannot be compelled to discuss a particular current event or an event or an issue that is somehow viewed as widely debated or currently controversial. And that was kind of the main part of that legislation that I think stood out for a lot of teachers, a lot of principals, a lot of superintendents. What exactly does this mean? How does this translate? And will this have an effect on teachers? Will teachers be afraid, for example, to talk about the George Floyd case or the next time there is a national awakening around a certain civil rights or social justice issue?
David, I'm really curious about what your sense is that where teachers are on this. I mean, is there like a substantial group, do you think, that will work around this? If so, how extensive would you think that would be?
Based on my experience, I think it is going to have a kind of a chilling effect on teachers. I do think there are certainly teachers who are critically engaged, who are excited to talk about current events and controversial issues in class, and they see that as their role, especially as a social studies teacher. When I did my master's at Johns Hopkins, that was something that we talked about, like that you have a role as a social studies teacher to engage with students in meaningful ways. But unfortunately, with so much emphasis placed on standardized tests, especially, you know, with 3 school years of disruption caused by the pandemic, I think principals and teachers are under immense pressure to perform on assessments. And so I think, first of all, too many teachers and principals' priorities are on just achieving those test scores, and not enough priorities are on, you know, making sure students are critically engaged on a variety of issues. So I think that's probably the biggest obstacle. And then I think we're not preparing teachers to teach in these types of ways. and teachers don't have the time and access to information to inform themselves, then it's going to be really difficult for a large group of teachers to engage in this work. And I do know that some teachers who are current or former students are a little bit afraid to broach certain issues because of the way they deem their administration or the things they've heard about the legislation in the media that may not be true, but just the myth of what the bill actually says, I think can constrain them from taking on some of these issues.
What do you know of that's out there to educate teachers and administrators, especially here in Texas, about being able to work around the law that's now on the books? I've also heard that there are protections. Obviously, the teachers that belong to unions will have protections, you know, if they go against what the law is at the time. And as you also said, that there's a lot of leeway in how the law itself is interpreted. So I'm just curious what's going on as far as informing teachers and administrators about this.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's part of why I wanted to write the op-ed, is to also kind of clarify what's going on. And I wrote one similar on HB 3979. Hopefully, both teachers, school districts, their professional organizations provide them with updates on legislation, because HB 3979 doesn't stop them from teaching about racism, doesn't kind of include some of the maybe more problematic aspects that the proposed SB 3 had in it. It really just noted that teachers couldn't be compelled to discuss these types of current events or so-called controversial public policy issues. And so if they were compelled personally, if they wanted to, if their students were asking them about these issues and they wanted to take them on, then I think they can. And hopefully both their administration, the school district itself, and then also their professional associations within the state and the teachers' unions are informing them that they do have these rights. And there's other things in the Texas Education Code where, you know, teachers have a degree of autonomy in making decisions about the content they teach. They have to, of course, follow standards, but the standards are not so prescribed that teachers can't pull in certain texts, certain primary source documents, or kind of develop units and themes, lessons that explore some of these issues.
If we could just wind back a little bit here, we sort of glossed over critical race theory, or CRT, it's often seen in the media. That's getting a lot of play in the press, and I suspect especially in the Fox News end of the spectrum. Could you define that for our listeners? Does that really play into HB 3979 and the efforts of social study teachers, for example?
One thing, I started in education in 2005, a master's and a PhD in education, and actually through my training to prepare to be a teacher, to prepare to be an administrator, getting my PhD, I'd actually never heard of critical race theory. I never read an article or a book on critical race theory through all of my undergraduate and graduate preparation. It wasn't really until I became a professor that I was exposed to the theory. So I do find it shocking that it's being presented as something that is pervasive in society, when for somebody who's worked in education in different states at different universities, didn't really come to know it until becoming a professor. The other thing that I think is really interesting about CRT is I think actually if most people knew what CRT was, they'd probably agree with it without even knowing. So there's a few facets or tenets to CRT, but I guess maybe starting with it, it's a theory that comes out of the field of law. And some of those tenets include that race is a social construction, that racism is a normal feature of society and it's embedded within systems and institutions. And so it's not just a few bad apples who are racist, but there are unseen forces, kind of the ways in which things have been done that are more systemic. And then importantly, I mean, this really connects to the conversation that we're having. CRT calls for a recognition of the everyday lives and lived experiences of people of color, which in history has often been excluded. So I think if you talk to most people who say they're anti-CRT and you approach the conversation a little differently and you ask them some of these questions about CRT or talked about it, I think a lot of people would agree with it. I think the way the media and some politicians have presented it, they've done so in a way that, first of all, doesn't represent what CRT is. And second, it really is alarming people and making them afraid that schools are somehow teaching white children to hate themselves or their histories or their ancestors, which is entirely not the case.
Well, it's certainly become a rallying point for the far right. It seems to be inspiring a great deal of fear. I was reading about something called the 1836 Project here in Texas, which apparently is a state effort to bolster tourism and to feature the sites in the history of Texas, you know, the Alamo being the crown jewel, as it were. The name, the 1836 Project, stands in contrast to the 1619 Project, which was a series of articles that the New York Times ran about the 500th anniversary of Jamestown. What do you think is going on here? With everything so polarized, how do we cut through this?
Yeah, the politics of this are pretty tricky, but I mean, it seems like a pretty thinly veiled attempt to whitewash history and maybe rally a political base that doesn't maybe fully recognize what 1836 might mean to other people. So again, kind of going back to CRT, that recognizing the lived experiences of other people, for some, 1836 doesn't necessarily connect entirely to the independence. It also connects to slavery and exploitation for people of color.
The new book on the Alamo, I just want to ask you what you think about it.
Well, I'm definitely not an expert on Texas history, but I enjoyed reading it, first of all, and I think it covered a lot of important ground. And what I really appreciated about the book, so first they provide a historical account of the Battle of the Alamo, some of the antecedents to the battle, and some of what happened after. And then they kind of talk about the historiography of the battle, so how the writing about the Battle of the Alamo evolved over time. I think that's really important for teachers to see, because I think as teachers, a lot of times we push our students to be a little bit skeptical of what you read in the textbooks and instead, you know, encourage them to think for themselves and to be critical readers and to look for other sources of information and other facts, look at primary source documents. And so I think it's really interesting that the Forget the Alamo book talks about the way the history developed and how that history was really focused on the experiences of a particular group, was really rooted in a great deal of racism towards Tejanos, towards Mexico, the framing of different characters in the story. And then I think even the book goes a bit further in talking about kind of the current political context and how the history of the Alamo has always kind of been somewhat contested by different groups. So, I think it's a great history book in and of itself, because for students who read it or for teachers who read it, it's really a case study of a historical event that you could then ask yourself a different question or look at a different topic in history and consider, well, is what's in our textbook about the experiences of Native Americans, can we draw parallels to the way the Battle of the Alamo or the Texas Revolt has been framed in our textbook? So I think it's a fantastic book.
Well, it certainly got under Dan Patrick's skin.
That it did. What is most interesting, the summers are pretty busy for me, kind of reading and preparing and writing. And because of it getting under Dan Patrick's skin, it popped up on my news feed. And I was like, oh, well, if the book is drawing that much controversy, let me prioritize some time and read it. I have to admit, I might not have read it or read it as quickly if it wasn't for Dan Patrick's comments. Actually appreciative that he called it out.
Let me ask you another question, David, and that's about the anti-intellectual thing that goes on in our country. Are we about the same level, or are we in a different level these days?
I don't know, but I will say, so I try to write op-eds that explain what I think are important issues in public education. Kind of feel like that's my role as a researcher and somebody who was a teacher and administrator and now kind of working in higher education. Sometimes I get really nasty comments from people from all varying positions. But usually I get emails from people who disagree with what I write, but do so in respectful ways, or at least in ways that I think they're trying to be respectful. And I have some hope there. I do think there's just so much, I don't know that it's anti-intellectual. I think there's so much bombardment in the media and so much polarization in our society that when you write about something or talk about something that uses one of those buzzwords, people just automatically jump or snap. And then we all kind of look at the most extreme responses. I think most Texans would want to know the true story of the Battle of the Alamo. It's just kind of removing all of that noise that exists out there. And I think most teachers would want to teach that, make sure they actually have adequate facts and resources to teach, and then go ahead and do that work.
Speaking of your op-ed, you referenced SB3, and could you provide maybe a contrast between HB 3979, which was signed into law, and SB3, which I guess is still hanging out there, and Abbott is promoting this on the agenda of the special sessions. Is that right?
Again, HB 3979 was really about ensuring that teachers can't be compelled to discuss certain current events and controversial issues or so-called controversial issues. It didn't really try to remove key aspects of the curriculum. Now, SB3 that was proposed during the first special session, it removed a lot of things that would typically be covered in the curriculum. So it stripped out requirements that include Native American history, the work of Cesar Chavez, Dolores Huerta, documents that students would read, so primary source documents students would read related to the Chicano movement and women's suffrage, from Martin Luther King, so removing the letter from a Birmingham jail, writings of Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony. It also removed requirements to teach about the eugenics movement and the KKK. And so just by removing these requirements, it doesn't mean that teachers couldn't still teach about them, but those were no longer requirements. And it just seems so strikingly odd and problematic that with all that's going on right now in our society and within our state, that we would have legislation proposed that would remove critical parts of our history and information that students really need to understand the society in which they live.
Our guest this evening is David DeMatthews, Associate Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy at UT Austin. We're discussing SB 3 and critical race theory. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. The following is an encore presentation that first aired on August 17, 2021. The segment with Brant Bingaman from the Austin Chronicle toward the end of the show is new and was recorded on March 31, 2022. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on August 11th. Our guest this evening is David DeMatthews, Associate Professor of Educational Leadership and Policy at UT Austin. We're discussing SB 3 and critical race theory. Let's pick up where we left off.
What institutions like UT, for example, are doing to kind of prepare the next wave of educators on the topics of history and even the whole movement towards anti-racism teaching, I think, in general, so that affects every subject that's taught in schools these days. I think I'm the only one here that actually took Texas history because I went to school in Texas. And I know that the teachings on Texas history have improved somewhat since I was a child. I have a teacher in my family now. My oldest daughter is a teacher, but she's a science teacher and she went to UT. So I'm just curious how things, especially in the last couple of years with all this talk going on, how is the university itself addressing this and making sure that the teachers are being prepared for this onslaught that they're facing and still being able to teach what needs to be taught?
SB3, you know, has not been passed. And again, I think as Bob mentioned, the governor has encouraged in the upcoming special session, if it actually happens, that they look at SB3 again, the proposed SB3. But I think most universities, including UT, there are both national standards for preparing teachers and also standards around preparing social studies teachers or science teachers or math teachers. And then in states like Texas, which like to have kind of its own set of standards, there's also kind of certain expectations, and every institution in the state adheres to those expectations. And those standards don't include some of this type of stuff in the first place. So kind of whitewashing history. But I think at UT or at any institution, especially for social studies teachers, teachers who might be teaching Texas history or American history, it's really important. And there's an emphasis typically that they have strong content knowledge, that they understand history from diverse perspectives. And so I do think at most universities, they may not be getting a course specifically on critical race theory. They're likely not getting any course on critical race theory, but I do think they're reading a broad selection of books and materials. Professors are providing lectures with greater diversity of information, and hopefully they're able to pull that into the classroom. And then I think, you know, depending on departments, when you look across Texas universities or across the country, the faculty's perspectives do help to shape the way the curriculum and programs are developed. And I think that that is important too. And so we really care about ensuring that teachers and principals teach in ways that promote equity and are culturally responsive. And so I think that's a shift you're seeing across the country as well.
Thinking about the Texas legislature and its efforts to revise history, I'm reminded of just three sessions ago, 2015, when there was at least talk about referring to enslaved people as immigrant workers. I'm just curious, did that ever make it into law?
I'm not entirely sure. I need to look back, but I do know we've had some issues with adopted textbooks in the past. And I do think we had adopted a textbook from one of the big publishers that used a select term like immigrant worker or something to describe slaves. And, you know, the publisher apologized, but I think it was something that really stands out as glaring and problematic that a history textbook in the United States would actually make that type of mistake or decide to make that immigrant workers and placed enslaved people.
Yeah, there was a whole history of the Texas legislature over the last 10, 20 years, particularly around themes of evolution, for example, and religion that I don't recall the specifics either, but I just shake my head, as I'm sure you and many of your colleagues do too. Thinking of broader terms here, back to the theme about extremes and this whole thing becoming a battleground, I always try to make sense out of what's going on in current events, you know, which quickly these days roll themselves into history. I think about the election of Barack Obama in 2008, followed by the election of Donald Trump, and then just a year ago, Black Lives Matter. Do you have any sense as an historian about weaving these into a thread and what caused what and where we're headed at this point? I mean, do you have a crystal ball?
I don't. I'm thinking maybe Jim does.
Don't we wish? David, I was listening to your comments. This legislation, what it really does is it protects those teachers, let me say East Texas, for example, that don't want to face reality or have their students face reality. And actually, that seems to me to be pretty dangerous because they can weave their curriculum the way they want to weave it. And if somebody says an administration, you should do this, then they can point to that law as a way of ducking their responsibilities. Actually, I see that to be a lot more pernicious in that way than I think I had contemplated in the beginning.
That's a good point, Jim. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but Yeah, and that upholds the white supremacist ideology that's out there, doesn't it, in a kind of insidious way.
There can be a great deal of groupthink, right? So I think oftentimes administrators get viewed as bullies of teachers. And, you know, sometimes that was the case. I've been on kind of both sides of that. But administrators were also teachers and often in those same communities. And so you're often talking about the same people. So it could be a way for a school entirely to avoid having those types of conversations. And when families show up at school board meetings, the district and the schools themselves can kind of absolve themselves from talking about those particular issues, which can be pretty problematic. But the one thing I've learned as a teacher and also as a school administrator is it's hard to legislate what a teacher does. Even as a principal, it's hard to legislate what a teacher does because, you know, you have 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 classrooms in a school all going on and one or two administrators. Teachers know that, whether it's teaching about race or the Battle of the Alamo, or if it's just turning on the TV and letting students kind of do whatever they want. Teachers know they have autonomy in the classroom. And so they're kind of viewed as these street level bureaucrats that are the final policy makers and decision makers of any policy. And I think good principals and teachers are going to still teach about these things. And I'm sure even in East Texas, there are pockets where educators are really trying to connect students with this information. And then I'm sure there's other pockets where, regardless of what the curriculum says, they're going to teach a whitewashed version. And I think the best that we can hope for is that we continue to try to push educators in their preparation and their professional development. We show up at school board meetings and we push superintendents to prioritize teaching a history that is informative and tells the truth about our history for better and for worse.
You've just provided some really great concluding thoughts there.
Well, I know you asked about from the first Black president with Barack Obama and then Donald Trump and Black Lives Matter, and then also what we saw happen on January 6th. I do think we're very polarized time. There's a lot of misinformation out there. And now we have policymakers that are dipping their toes into what kind of what's happening in curriculum in very problematic ways. And to me, I'm still hopeful though. All of this tells me that what teachers do really matters. At least for me personally, being someone who works with teachers every day and works with principals and superintendents, I'm excited to get up. I'm hopeful because I know there are good people working in our schools that really want the best for students, and that regardless of the policies and challenges that exist for teachers, they're going to find ways to do what's right for kids. And the more we can draw attention to these problematic policies and get voters concerned about these problematic policies, the easier the jobs will be for teachers and principals. But I still think the majority of them are going to do what they think is best for kids. And I'm still optimistic, even in some kind of difficult times right now.
Jim, anything else you wanted to add?
I have two kids that are teachers, you know, so I have enormous, enormous respect for teachers. I'm not so sanguine that all teachers are trying to do their best for the kids. That's the problem. And I think that we see a lot of teachers who will use these laws as a reason not to get educated, to continue to sort of slough off their responsibilities. And you're right. I mean, of course, it's not just East Texas. I mean, you can go anywhere. This is just part of this movement to be fact adverse. I've referred to it as anti-intellectual earlier. We see that all the facts are being driven by people's politics. And that lack of critical thinking, I think, is really problematic. And I don't see it happening as well and or as much as it ought to be in school, and particularly in high schools.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree. I have a positive outlook, I think maybe in part because I have to do this work every day. And I think you're right. A lot of people's facts are driven by politics, but I still do think that there is a positive trajectory among teachers and how they're prepared and supported and the information they have access to. From when I started teaching in 2005 to today. But I also agree with you that teachers can be very insulated, set in their ways, and despite all the progress in terms of developing curricular materials and preparation programs that focus more on equity and provide facts that maybe they didn't 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, that some people can still be pretty recalcitrant. So I see that too, but I'm still hopeful that over time we'll look back at some of these issues and we'll probably still be fighting over something, but hopefully we'll have moved the needle a little bit.
Well, I can tell you, as one who tutors math these days, I have an even greater appreciation for how much easier my job is than social studies teachers.
Thanks for all your good work, David. Thanks for everything you're doing. It's really good.
Thank you. And thanks for all the work that you've done.
Yeah, we really appreciate having you on. This has been in the news quite a bit lately, and it's wonderful to have an outspoken leader like yourself clarifying the issues here and enlightening us. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
It's Thursday, March 31st, and we have Brent Bingaman with us, reporter for the Austin Chronicle. How are you doing this evening, Brent?
I'm doing good, Bob. How are you doing?
Okay. Well, it's good to hear your voice. It was not so good to read your piece in the current edition of the Austin Chronicle. It deals with a suicide at the Travis County Jail and a man named JJ. Tell us about him and the circumstances of his death.
Thanks, Bob. I'll do so. Well, JJ Bell, Jared JJ Bell, he was going to be 33 years old on March the 7th, but a month before, on February the 7th, his brother, Mark Bell, got a message that JJ wasn't doing well. And Mark, who lives outside of Austin, drove in and found that his brother was in the throes of a psychotic break. And Mark tried to talk him down for about 8 hours. He sat with him and he said that JJ cycled in and out of lucidity during that time. But at the end of the 8 hours, he didn't seem to really be improving. And Mark needed to go to Bastrop and work the next day. So he had been trying to find a rehab facility for JJ. And ultimately, he decided to try the sobering center. So he got JJ in the car and began driving down to the sobering center, which is right in the middle of downtown Austin. And as he was getting close at a stoplight, JJ bolted from the car and Mark had to chase him for about an hour. He finally did get into the sobering center and they told him that they couldn't take him because they worked off of recommendations. They told Mark that either the police or a hospital needed to refer JJ. So Mark turned around and took JJ to Del Seton Medical Center, which was only a couple of blocks away. So Mark checked his brother into the hospital and he talked to a nurse. He made it very plain to the nurse. He said, look, my brother is a schizophrenic. He's a drug addict. He's been in and out of touch with reality, probably for several days, and he's suicidal. So he asked the nurse, please keep my brother here. And if you do discharge him from the hospital, let me know. This is my number. Please call me immediately. And so Mark Bell then went home, went to work the next day. And the next day he got a call from the Travis County Sheriff's Office. And he didn't pick up, but he assumed that his brother had wound up at the jail. And that was true. He got a couple more calls from the jail that day as he was working in Bastrop. And he was in an area with poor cell service. So he didn't find out about these calls until later on. And then finally, the next day, he got a call that went through. And the people at the sheriff's office told him that his brother had killed himself and that he'd been found with his back against the wall with a telephone cord wrapped around his neck.
Jesus.
Yeah, very sad. Very sad.
Yeah.
And Mark was devastated.
Yeah.
And he wants to know how it all happened. But it's hard to get anything more than just a sketch of what occurred.
Yeah.
It's a death in custody report that was made public. The jail is required to make these reports when somebody dies at the jail. Mm-hmm. And it's very basic. It said that Jared J.J. Bell was admitted to the downtown jail on February 7th at 11:27 p.m. During booking, he reportedly expressed suicidal ideation. You know, he said that he had been thinking about killing himself, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And that triggers oversight by the jail staff, the corrections officers. Depending on what is expressed by the person being booked, they'll either look at this person, do a visual check of this person every 30 minutes or even as often as every 15 minutes. So he was being observed every 30 minutes at least. But on the morning of February 9, 36 hours after he had been booked into the jail, he asked to make a phone call and he was placed in a day room that had a corded telephone at 9:19 a.m. And he was discovered dead a little less than an hour later at 10:13 a.m. He had used the telephone cord, like I said, to asphyxiate himself.
Wow.
Officers immediately began CPR. The paramedics continued to provide that when they arrived, but he was pronounced dead at 11:07, so a little less than 36 hours after entering the jail. But there's not a great deal besides that that we can know, because there's several rules that the jail must follow when someone dies that preclude officials from going into any detail about what happened.
I get it. There's all kinds of family and privacy affairs, I'm sure. But at the same time, you just got to wonder about what kind of supervision he might have been getting there at the jail, you know?
Yeah. He was probably getting good supervision because the Travis County Sheriff's Office has a good reputation. Our jail here in Travis County is one of the better regarded ones in the state. Also, I spoke to this attorney who handles these types of cases more so than any other attorney in the state. His name is Dean Malone. And he said that although the Texas Commission on Jail Standards requires jail personnel to check on people every 30 minutes, anything less than continuous monitoring is really inadequate. A person can kill themselves with a bed sheet or a phone cord in just 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah.
But other experts say that it's inappropriate to continuously monitor people.
You had some pictures of JJ in your story. He was somewhat known here in the Austin community.
He was really well known in the EDM community. And this is a group of folks who I don't know that well, even though I'm in the music scene. But he had literally hundreds of friends. It is quite sad. I mean, when I am writing these stories, it hurts.
Oh, yeah.
It actually hurts. I feel pain. You know, sometimes I weep when I write these stories. I don't know if you want to put this on the radio. I will be weeping.
I certainly hear you. I've experienced suicides in my own life. One of them took me months to get through, you know. I totally get it. It's a very disturbing episode for everybody. Was the jail at least cooperative? I mean, insofar as they could be, did you get the information that you needed for the story okay?
They're wonderful, you know, or at least I should say Kristen Dark, who's the spokesperson for the jail. She's a great communicator and a caring person. But there's just very little that she could actually tell me, though.
I get it.
She did tell me that, you know, suicides are rising in jails across the country, and they have been for the last 20 years. Point that about a decade ago, it became the number one cause of death in jails.
Wow.
But she said that Travis County's jail isn't necessarily part of that trend. There aren't that many successful suicides at our jails here in Travis County. There were 4 in the last year, in 2021. But before that, in 2020, there were none. And in 2019, there were only 2. Meanwhile, from the years 2018 to 2020, the corrections officers stopped about 92 suicide attempts.
Well, that's laudable, you know?
Yeah. So.
Well, in another recent story that you wrote, I think it was published in last week's Chronicle, you talked about racial profiling in APD. We've covered that before on this show, so it's nothing new. I guess we were hoping that things might improve over time. Is that the case?
Apparently not. The numbers in terms of who is being racially profiled are about the same as they've been for the last 5 years, you know, about as long as we've been keeping any decent records of it. And what those break down to are, in brief, African Americans make up about 7.5% of Austin's population, but they're stopped twice as often as that, about 15%. Hispanics make up about a third, 34% of the population. They're stopped at 37%, so a little bit more than their share of the population. White folks represent 48% of the city's population. They're stopped at 43% of the population. So you can see that it's Black folks mostly who are really stopped more often than their shares of the population. That's the same numbers that it's been for a while, like I said. And really, this report, these are just raw numbers, so it's kind of hard to say a great deal about them. Mm-hmm. But another thing that's interesting to note is who's being arrested. Mm-hmm. So Black folks are arrested at numbers that are higher than they're stopped at. They're arrested 18% of the time when they're stopped. Mm-hmm. Hispanics, again, same picture. Yeah. They're arrested 48% of the time, even though they make up 34% of the population. And mm-hmm. white folks are arrested less often, 32% of the time, even though they make up 48% of the population. So these are things that you would sort of expect, unfortunately. One of the things that the folks I spoke with said was that what's interesting in the report is what's not part of it. And that is that you don't get to see anything about which individual officers did which arrests. This is something that the Office of Police Oversight and other advocates have been pushing for the last couple of years. APD knows which officers are arresting which people at what rates with what outcomes, but that is the type of information that they work very hard to conceal, hard to keep from reaching the public. Advocates are going to continue pushing to get that information. But that's why these types of reports are still kind of unsatisfying. You don't really get to see what's going on. And the Kroll report, that report that was authorized by the city council back in 2019, they did a survey of Austin police officers, and they know that there is a small minority of officers who do more arresting and who use force more often. There's about 1,800 officers, and I think the report implied rather strongly that it's somewhere between 50 and 100 officers are really using force more often than their peers. The Office of Police Oversight and a lot of other advocates, they would really like to know which officers these are, you know?
Right. Or at the very least, track it down to the fact that it's a disproportionate number of officers doing this disproportionate number of stops, you know, and arrests.
Exactly. And you can kind of get a sense for it, a very shadowy sense, by looking at which officers are facing discipline. But again, this is something that's known by the police. It's just not known by the public.
A week or two ago, we did a whole review with Austin Sanders about the maze of accountability with APD within the police department itself. You've got the command structure, you've got internal affairs, its own investigative unit. And then, you know, you peel that back and you've got OPO, you know, a city agency trying to keep tabs on the police. And then beyond that, you've got the courts, both the civil courts. From the Black Lives Matter protests, we've seen so far four of those cases result in more than $13 million in settlements. And then you've got the DA coming in through criminal indictments and 19 officers there. So, you know, it's something of a maze, but I guess we can hope that truth will win out in all this, that if there are police who are disproportionately making these stops and arrests, that someday this will come to the light of day.
Absolutely, Bob. And you know, the advocates aren't going to stop pushing.
Yeah, you cited some of them in your report. Is it Just Liberty?
Just Liberty.
They're keeping a real close eye on all this.
Oh, yes. Austin Justice Coalition. There's a lot of them out there.
Well, we really appreciate your taking time out for us here
this evening, Brant, and always appreciate your reporting. I think I speak for many in the city of Austin in expressing gratitude for your work. So thank you so much.
I'm grateful for you, Bob. Thanks.
That's all from us this evening. Stay safe, everyone. Stay tuned for Co-op's local music mix next on the HD3 channel and on coop.org.